Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3, here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel and Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel and Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You are listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel and Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X.
Good morning. Welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, yes. 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there, anywhere in the world, apparently. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. This show is all about science in all its different forms. We're every week. You've got Julian Paul here in the studio live as usual. We'll be talking to our PG later on. And we've also got a guest speaker for this Saturday, and indeed every third Saturday of the month. And it's Gareth Morgan, who's a member of and also its president of the Sheffield Photographic Society. Next week, and indeed every fourth Saturday of the month, our guest speaker is Chris Dale. I think, not sure what he's going to be talking about this time. Might be food related, might be to do with forever chemicals in your blood. All good stuff, eh? Before we go on any further, a reminder that Mechsbert and Swinton Astronomical Society have their Planets in the Park event next Saturday. That's the 28th of February 2026. It takes place from 6 p.m. to about 8:30 p.m. in the evening. And it is an evening of stargazing and planet watching at Clifton Park Garden House and Courtyard in Rotherham. That's S65 2AA. It's a free event. No booking is required, and it's suitable for all ages. Presentations and displays will complement observing of the night sky, and if you have a telescope and require advice, please bring it along. Wrap up warm for the evening. Refreshments will be available for a small charge. Fingers crossed that the weather will be good. For regular listeners, you know that Phil Muffett from the Mechsbert and Swinton Astronomical Society does speak to us every first Saturday of the month, and indeed if there are any five Saturdays in the month as well. Also, another reminder, you can check out smartphonefreechildhood.org. You can sign the parent pack there online and join parents in your area who are delaying smartphones and social media. Hot topic at the minute, but as far as I'm concerned, it's not just about children and smartphones, it's about adults as well. Also, another reminder that Sheffield Photographic Society will have their annual exhibition this year at Sheffield Cathedral. It runs from Friday the 20th of March until Monday the 30th of March. So put that in your diary. I'm sure Gareth will talk to us about that a bit later on. Next up, a story was in the news this week about an NHS study to transform mental health treatment.
Yes, thousands of people in England with severe mental health problems are being recruited for a study
that could help develop personalised treatments for conditions such as schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. The research, which is being supported by 10 NHS trusts, could transform the understanding of severe mental illness, officials said. Some 49,000 people are being sought to take part in the three-year project known as Global Minds. Eligible patients with conditions such as severe depression and psychosis are to be identified and contacted using NHS England's DigiTrails service. That's DigiTrails service. Those taking part will be given at-home sampling kits with experts combining genetic data from blood or saliva with questionnaire responses and NHS medical records. The aim is to develop detailed data on severe mental health conditions to improve diagnosis and to potentially develop personalised treatments. Dr. Adrian James, NHS England's National Medical Doctor for Mental Health and Neurodiversity, said this major new study could transform our understanding of severe mental illness and lead to the dawn of a new era of personalised treatments for patients with conditions including schizophrenia and severe depression. People living with a severe mental illness are affected by their condition every day, and it can often lead to preventable physical conditions and shorter lifespans. He says, I'd encourage anyone contacted to consider sign up to be part of this groundbreaking study. The study is being led by the mental health data science company Akriva, A-K-R-I-V-I-A, Health, in partnership with Cardiff University. It has been launched in England and Wales, which plans to expand internationally. About 2,000 patients are already enrolled, and 1,000 people with dementia will also take part. According to Mind, the mental health charity, about 1 in 5 adults in England have a common mental health condition, such as anxiety or depression. It also estimates that the proportion of people reporting severe mental health problems rose from 7% in 1993 to nearly 12% in 2023-24.
Yeah, interesting stuff, eh? Before I move on to it, I talk a little bit about an article in the news this week about diets. A quick reminder that if you tuned in at the end of Soul Plus, just before the Live Science Show, you'd have heard Paul Hardcastle's The Wizard, which was used for Top of the Pops way back. And you were saying, Paul, that actually, that was back in 1986, that was the first artist to record directly onto hard drive, was it?
Yes.
Wow, all these facts, that better be right now, because you are, of course, listening to the Life Science
sure.
Radio Show.
You
on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. So this article was about different diets could help men and women live longer. And the key is, scientists think that diets for men and women should be different. So here we go. So men should steer clear of fruit juice and cake and have plenty of coffee and fibre, but women should eat more fish and dairy to improve their longevity. So scientists have revealed sex-specific diet tips for middle-aged people who want to add 2 to 3 years to their lives. The link between a healthy diet and a lower risk of dying early from a range of diseases is well established. But researchers in the UK and China assess whether women and men should have different priorities. So data from more than 100,000 British people has indicated that a 45-year-old man can add 1.9 to 2 to 3 years to his life, so that's basically 2 to 3 years to his life, with a diet designed to reduce the risk of diabetes. And a 45-year-old woman could add 1.5 to 2.3 years to their life with a form of the Mediterranean diet. So researchers from Queen Mary University, the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and the Haozhong University of Science and Technology analysed data from 103,649 people held in the UK Biobank to look at 5 diets and their effects on all-cause mortality. Participants were followed for 10.6 years on average, during which period 4,314 of them died. Their ages and causes of death were analysed with data about their dietary habits. So, the best diets for men and women overlapped, and both were recommended to eat more nuts, fruit, and unsaturated fats. But for women, whole grains, vegetables, legumes, fish, and dairy were recommended, and a moderate alcohol intake was beneficial. Red meat was the only thing women were told to reduce. For men, fibre and coffee were recommended, and trans fats found in some baked and fried goods, as well as sugar sweetened beverages and fruit juice, were to be avoided along with red meat. So this research was published in the journal Science Advances to coincide with a meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Phoenix, Arizona. Men benefited most from the diabetes reduction, diabetes risk reduction diet. A 45-year-old man who followed that diet was basically could expect to live another 36.7 years against 33.6 years for men with diets that were not like that at all. So for women, the best diet was the alternate Mediterranean diet, which has a scoring system for food groups. A 45-year-old woman whose diet scored highly could expect to live for another 39.4 years on average, compared with 37.1 years for those who had the lowest score diet. So in summary, the recommended advice for women, for men and women, and this is middle-aged people, is recommended for both men and women is nuts, fruit, unsaturated fats. Recommended for men, fiber and coffee. Recommended for women, whole grains, vegetables, legumes, fish and dairy. Men and women should avoid red meat, and men should avoid trans fats, sugar sweetened drinks and fruit juice. Most interesting, eh? Unmistakable sound there of In Excess and Taste It, because we were talking about different diets could help men and women live longer. You are, of course, listening to Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM. All being well, RPG should be on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Oh, we've plugged you in correctly. That's always good on live radio, as you know. I think we got it a bit wrong last week. Never mind. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week then, PG?
Oh, well, what caught my eye literally was last night. I went out to see what my cat was up to in the garden and looked across to the west, and it appeared to be a lunar eclipse. But there was heavy clouds, so it was really difficult. So I'm hoping that our film might be able to tell us whether possibly I could have seen a lunar eclipse. There was a very small crescent at the bottom of the moon, very bright, but the rest of the moon was dark. So it appeared sort of correct that I don't think it could have been the cloud cover, but I couldn't find any information when I was looking around to see if it could have been a eclipse. We do get several lunar eclipses through a year, so it's not always sort of headline news, but I thought it was quite an interesting thing. Just obviously the sort of moon's heading over that way at night towards the west as the Earth rotates, and the Earth is four times the size of the Moon, so once it blocks the light from the Sun, that's how we get the eclipse. So I'd be interested to find out. I'll do a bit more studying for that one. The other kind of things that came, which is something that's not to be sniffed at, is potentially a cure-all for coughs, colds, flu, and bacterial infections of the lung.
That sounds marvellous, Paul.
It's, some work's been done in the US of A, and they've come up with a vaccine which doesn't need to be injected by needle. It's actually a nasal spray. And they say that it's proving to be very effective against a wide range of problems with health, sort of nasal passages, lungs, and the sort of respiratory system infections. And what they say is that they've taken a different approach. Normally speaking, vaccines that we get, the flu vaccine and other things, are training our own sort of defense system to be specifically targeting the particular thing that we're being vaccinated for. Now, this alternative is a broad spread thing that actually arms our defense systems across the board against these kind of invasions that come through the kind of winter cold, the flu, and say some bacterial infections. It's got promising results, they say, but no sort of deadline at the moment for when it might be releasable. So, kind of interesting development. Lots of things going on with medical sort of treatment and AI. But one of the things that you were talking about is sort of mental health and brain health. So I thought it might be a good thing this week just to have a quick sort of circuit through what is the brain.
Oh, Paul, good luck with that.
Well, we've spoken about it before. We've spoken about some of the things that have been happening with it. But it's a kind of complex organ that controls our thoughts, memories, emotions, touch, motor skills, vision, breathing, temperature, hunger, and every process that regulates our bodies. So together the brain and spinal cord extend to make up the central nervous system. So what's it made of? Well, it weighs on average about 3 pounds in an average adult, and 60% of that is fat. The remaining 40% is a combination of water, protein, carbohydrates and salts. And the brain's not a muscle, but it does contain blood vessels and nerves, including neurons and glial cells. Basically, it's a portion in two areas. That's the grey matter and the white matter, different regions of the central nervous system. So grey matter refers to the darker outer portion on the brain, while the white matter describes lighter inner sections underneath that. In the spinal cord, that order's reversed. So the white matter's on the outside in the spinal matter, and the grey matter sits within that. So it's primarily composed, the grey matter, of neuronsomas. They're round central cell bodies. And the white matter is mostly made up of axons. They're long stems that connect neurons together. And they tend to be wrapped in, they are wrapped in myelin, which is a protective coating. And the different composition of neuron parts is why the two appear to have separate shades on certain scans. So what's it actually doing? That's the kind of question that gets asked. Well, it sends and receives chemical and electrical signals throughout the body, and different signals control different processes, and your brain interprets each. Some make you feel tired, while others will make you feel pain. Some messages are kept within the brain, while others are relayed through your spine and across the body's network of nerves to distant extremities. And to do that, the central nervous system relies on billions of neurons, they're nerve cells. And at a high level, the brain can be divided into the cerebrum, the brainstem, and the cerebellum. So the cerebrum sits on top, the cerebellum sits underneath that, and between the two and to the bottom end of that is the brainstem, which will head towards the spinal column as well. So the cerebrum is constructed really of the grey matter, and the white matter is the centre. So the largest part of the brain, the cerebrum, initiates and coordinates our movement and regulates temperature, amongst other things. Other areas that it works in enable speech, judgment, thinking, reasoning, problem-solving, emotions, and learning. And other functions relate to our vision, hearing, touch, and other senses. So it's pretty busy.
It's pretty, yeah, it's things you don't really think about. You just take it for granted, don't you, till one of that system breaks down.
Yeah, absolutely. So we know about it if something affects our sort of motor skills, because we start to not walk, be able to, we're falling down, that sort of thing. But in other areas, we can have those problems that appear as mental problems, mental issues. It can be a chemical imbalance in the brain. It can be an interpretation imbalance. And if we look back over the years, I think it's been shown that in ancient Egypt, they were undertaking brain surgery at sort of 4,000 years ago. And the thing that happens in prehistoric men, mankind, and it sort of is apparent, is a thing called trepanning. Which is where they open a section of the skull, and lots of conjecture as to whether that was in ancient times something to do with belief or often talk about as having a third eye, which is sort of the centre of the forehead eye into the cerebellum. And what trepanning could do was to open a window to expose the third eye. So kind of interesting that that moved on. And then in sort of the Navy, back in the sort of 17 to 1800s, people who got concussive injuries a lot of the time, depressed skull fractures, they started to try and pull the skull back out away from the brain. The problem is that pressure on the brain could be in one of those areas, and it could affect all sorts of things.
Oh, yeah, so
it could affect memory, could affect taste, it could affect smell, balance. So if a patient had those sorts of things, they started to do open surgery to remove any sort of splinters, any pieces of skull, and famously what they would do quite often is to take a coin, flatten it out and shape it to cover the aperture that was opened in the skull and fix it in place protect the brain from there on in. So
I wonder how many survived that, Paul.
A lot, surprisingly. I don't know, probably better in terms of survival than taking a limb off, which was equally one of the byproducts of battles at sea. So it's kind of interesting. But anyway, the cerebral cortex, cortex is the Latin for bark, the outer grey matter, and it's got a large surface area because it's all folded. So when you see a picture of a brain and it looks crinkly, it's all the folds, and that's about half of the weight of the brain. And it's divided roughly into two halves or hemispheres, and it's covered by the ridges and the folds, the gyri, the ridges, and sulci, and the folds, and the two halves join in a large, deep sulcus between the two hemispheres. So the medial longitudinal fissure is what it's called. Now that runs from the front of your head to the back, so you've got a half a brain either side, left and right. Now the right hemisphere controls the left side of your body, and the left controls the right side of your body.
Yeah.
So the two halves communicate with one another through a large C-shaped structure of white matter and nerve pathways. Oh, wow. That's called the corpus callosum. And the corpus callosum is the centre of the cerebrum. And as I said, down below everything, you've got the brain stem, often called the middle brain, and that connects your cerebrum to the spinal cord. And it includes the midbrain, the pons, and the medulla. So the midbrain is a complex structure with a range of different neuron clusters, neural pathways, and other structures. And these features facilitate various functions from hearing and movement to calculating responses and environmental changes. The midbrain also contains the substantia nigra, an area affected by Parkinson's disease that's rich in dopamine neurons and part of the basal ganglia, which enables movement and coordination. And then moving on, the pons part of it is the origin of four of the 12 cranial nerves. And they enable our activities like tear production, chewing, blinking, focusing vision, balance, hearing, and facial expression. And it's named for the Latin word for bridge, the pons. So it's the connection between midbrain and the medulla. And the medulla at the bottom of the brain stem is where the brain meets the spinal cord. And it's essential for survival. Its function helps to regulate a lot of bodily activities, including the rhythm of your heart, breathing, blood flow, oxygen and carbon dioxide levels, and it produces reflexive activities like sneezing or vomiting or coughing or swallowing. And the spinal cord extends from the bottom of that, which is the base of your brain, through a large opening at the bottom of the skull. It's supported by the vertebrae, and the spinal column carries messages to and from the brain out to the rest of the body.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's amazing what sits on top of your head, apart from headache.
But as we say, Paul, you know, you don't really think about it, the complexity of the brain, or indeed the rest of your body, but when things could start to go wrong and you see what the brain, different, if you get brain damage or you have a stroke or, you know, you get a degenerative
or you get drunk
mental illness like dementia or Alzheimer's, it's devastating effect, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've seen a couple of cases in the last year where brain surgery has been undertaken through things like hematoma, a blood clot or something on the brain. And they've actually done the operation working behind the screen with the patient actually aware and functioning. There's a lady who'd been a lifelong violinist, and to help her to work through this, she played the violin while they operated on her brain.
I saw that. Yeah.
Kind of amazing.
And you sort of see that, and quite often now you'll get interventions where they'll drill a very small hole to gain access to an area of the brain that appears to be malfunctioning, or they need to do something with. And a lot of the time now, I think we've spoken about using electrical pulses to change things within the body. There's also sort of things now where they'll scan the brain function. So quite often you'll see a CT scan, one of those things with huge machines, where they can actually look at the function of your brain. So they can play pictures to your eyes and record the areas of your brain that are triggered into functioning, and try and map relationships for various stimuli. So quite often there'll be a touch stimulus to see what happens when something touches your fingertips. It'll trigger that area of the brain. And so it's becoming a route to diagnosis of a lot of issues. And I think that's the sort of mechanical sort of linking. So brain coverings, they call the meninges, and they're three layers of coverings that surround the brain and the spinal cord. So, as I was saying, if you've got a depressed fracture, sometimes you can put pressure through these, and sometimes they've got to get through this. So the outermost layer is the dura mater, which is thick and tough, and that's two layers together, and it lines the inner dome of your skull, your cranium, and the meningeal layer is below that. Second one's the arachnoid matter, which is thin, web-like, hence the arachnoid. It's a web-like layer of connective tissue that doesn't contain nerves or blood cells. And below that is the cerebrospinal fluid, or CSF, to make it better. Below that, you've got the pia, P-I-A, matter, which is a thin membrane that hugs the surface of the brain and follows its contours. And that's very rich in veins and arteries. So that's the sort of wraparound for the human brain. So actually on the layout of the brain, you've got at the front, you've got the frontal lobe, which is a large part. Behind that, you've got parietal lobe. And below those two is the temporal lobe, and across at the back is the occipital lobe and the cerebellum and the spinal cord. So frontal lobe is personality characteristics are sort of controlled there. Decision-making, movement, your recognition of smell all involve parts of the frontal lobe. And it also contains what they call Broca's area, which is associated with your ability to speak. Below that, you've got parietal lobe. That's the middle part of the brain, and that helps you to identify objects and understand spatial relationships, where your body is compared with objects and your surroundings. And it's also involved in interpreting pain and touch. And the parietal lobe houses Wernicke's area, which helps the brain understand spoken language. The occipital lobe is the one behind that, and that's the back part of the brain, and that's involved with your vision. So we bring in light through our eyes, and they hit the retina at the back of the eye, and that's converted by the brain into what we understand as our vision, our sight. And then you've got the temporal lobe, that's the sides of the brain, and they're involved in short-term memory, speech, musical rhythm, and some degrees of smell recognition. So you can see where brain damage can affect so many different areas, and the way to be able to see those now with the scanning techniques that we have gives a real sort of in-depth look at the function within the brain. So and hidden deep within the brain, you've got the pituitary gland, and that's sometimes called the master gland because it's only a pea-sized structure deep in your brain, and it's behind the bridge of your nose. And the gland, the pituitary gland, governs the function of other glands in your body. So that regulates your flow of hormones from your thyroid, adrenals, ovaries and testicles. And it receives chemical signals from the hypothalamus through the stalk and the blood supply. The hypothalamus is located above the pituitary gland and sends its chemical messages that control functions. It regulates body temperature, synchronizes sleep patterns, controls hunger and thirst, and also plays a role in some aspects of memory and emotion. And hidden away, you've got the amygdala, which is a small almond-shaped structure located under each hemisphere of the brain. And it's included in our limbic system, and they regulate emotion, memory, and are associated with the brain's reward systems, stress, and the fight or flight response. Then we've got hippocampus, which is a curved structure, a bit like a seahorse shape. It's on the underside of each temporal lobe, and it's part of a larger structure called the hippocampal formation, which supports memory, learning, navigation, perception of space. Also receives information from the cerebral cortex and plays a role in Alzheimer's.
Wow. And on that note, Paul, you might have to continue this next week.
Yes.
Because I'm going to have to get Gareth on.
Yes. Yeah.
Brilliant. Right. And you've chosen Can't Get You Out of My Head to play you out with Kylie Minogue, eh? Can't
okay.
beat it. Cheers, Paul.
Thank you,
we'll
Paul.
We'll speak
yeah.
on Monday. Bye-bye. Bye. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
With Kylie Minogue there, because our PG was talking about the functions of the brain. I think you might have to continue that next week. You're listening to the Life Science Radio Show, of course, here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have Gareth Morgan on the line. Morning, Gareth.
Good morning. Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. For people who don't know, you are a member of and also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society.
Yeah, that's right.
And your open competition for this year, for people to enter their photographs, deadline is today.
Yeah, you've got until midnight tomorrow.
See, you said you not had as many entries as last year.
Not quite as many. No. We've had some, I mean, they're quite good. Well, not quite good, they're very good. We've had some really good entries. Numbers are slightly down, which is...
But there's always
you
today.
You just never quite know. But, there's plenty to go at.
Yeah, you never quite know.
We'll be choosing the winner to go in our exhibition in a week or so.
Yeah, I picked up that your annual exhibition this year is at the Cathedral, Sheffield Cathedral again. And am I right in thinking it's Friday the 20th of March to Monday the 30th of March? Excellent.
That's right, yeah. We'll open, we'll probably have a formal opening lunchtime on the Friday.
Excellent.
So should be fun.
As always. So this week you're going to talk about photographic architecture.
Yes, I thought we might talk about photographing buildings and different types of architecture. It's kind of one of the more popular genres these days. You find lots of people like to get out and take pictures. And you think about it, when you're out on holiday, you're always taking pictures of castles and interesting buildings. But it's one of those subjects, it's kind of worth thinking about before you get into it.
Yeah, yeah.
And particularly, most types of photography, it's better to plan ahead. But with architecture, it's particularly important. I mean, there are two aspects, inside and outside, I guess. Let's talk about external photography first. There's quite a lot of factors you have to take into account, like, time of day. What's the light going to be like? Where it's coming from? What the viewpoints are, where can you get the best angle on the building? And is that actually the aspect you want to photograph? So more than most other types of photography, you really need to scout out places before you go and photograph them. Because otherwise you turn up and you just can't get a great view of things. It's surprising how often that happens.
What about the weather, I guess, as well? That's related to the light and the...
Yeah, I mean, weather is always a factor in photography, although if you're keen, unless the weather is absolutely awful.
Doesn't put you off.
And in fact, particularly if you're photographing buildings with interesting detail, you don't want it to be too bright and sunny. You want some nice light, cloud cover. It gives you that sort of pale light, and that enables you to bring out all the detail of the buildings. And that's kind of particularly important. There's one exception. The only type of building I really like to photograph in bright sunlight, it's kind of brutalist, modernist type buildings. So if you think about, Hyde Park Flats and around that,
yes,
they really work well because you get strong contrast. You get shadows and, deep sort of shadows, and you can expose the light areas and get lots of interesting shadow. And it just works particularly well with that type of architecture. But with most other types, you really want kind of soft lighting because it's all about line and form, shape and design, if you like. It's that's what you're after with a photograph of a building. So it pays to try and find the best conditions. I mean, composition-wise, you're looking for the most appealing angle, obviously, which means you need to find the best location. It's good to have some sort of leading lines to take you into the building. So if you can find a nice, set of buildings that lead into it, or a walkway or something like that, that always helps. But one of the key things you have to do is think about keeping the vertical straight. Because the problem with lots of buildings is they're a lot taller than we are.
Yes.
So when you photograph them, you tend to have to tilt the camera up. And of course, as you lean, the more you lean the camera back, the more the building will appear to lean away from you.
Yeah.
So you can end up with some very odd looking buildings. Sometimes it's interesting, it can work. But quite often, if you're doing like an architectural study, you want the building to appear straight. So it's quite important to think about that when you're doing it, and try and get the thing as vertical as you can. But then you have to recognize you're going to have to edit later on using Photoshop or whatever system you use. Just try and straighten up those verticals. I mean, there's a lot in the software now. There's a lot of tools to help you do that. In fact, in the new Lightroom thing, it enables you to kind of put a point on each corner that you want to be square.
Oh, really?
And then it lines everything up.
Oh.
And the other things stay in perspective.
Wow.
One of the troubles with the old ones was you could get one aspect of the building looking straight, but everything else looked a bit odd.
Looks out of kilter, doesn't it?
Yeah. So you have to kind of think about perspective when you're doing things like that. I mean, there are some tricks of the trade. You can buy things like there's a thing called a tilt shift lens, which a professional architectural photographer would use. And what that does is it allows you to change the angle between the sensor, which is capturing the image in your camera, and the lens on the front. So it literally tilts the lens a little bit in a different direction. And the shift is that you can physically move the lens up and down a little bit within its frame, which enables you to kind of straighten the building up as you're taking the image. The problem is, you know, you can't really use those kind of lenses for much else, so they are quite expensive.
Well, didn't think they were going to be cheap, Gareth.
No.
Somehow.
You're talking serious money to buy. But you know, there are some reasonably cheap ones out there, but they're a single-purpose one. I mean, you can use them for other things, but that's primarily what they're designed to do. So you'll see professional. I mean, you can always see they're a bit squarer than a normal lens because they obviously have a frame to move about in. But they kind of work quite well, and they're worth looking at. Then the other thing you have to think about, of course, is camera settings themselves. So with a building, you're trying to get lots of detail, but also lots of depth in the image. So you really need to set a fairly low ISO because you want a good quality image. So you want to be shooting around about 100 ISO if you can. If the lighting's not great, you can go up a little bit, but I wouldn't go above 400. I think above that, it starts to get a bit noisy. And I mean, although you can pull it back a bit in processing, it's too much effort.
When you say noisy, do you mean you're losing the definition, or it's
it's a bit grainy and it gets a bit soft around the edges and it's not as crisp.
Yes.
Whereas if you go, you know, if you keep it, your ISO down, it's nice and crisp. But of course the disadvantage of that is it doesn't let as much light.
Well, this is the art of photography, isn't it?
You have to balance it out. I know it's always fun. You need to look at a small aperture. So you're looking for depth of field. So you want to be at, I mean, I tend to shoot at F11 for buildings. F8 is probably as low as I would go. But, you know, F11 gives you quite a lot of depth, good detail. It allows a reasonable amount of light in. But then, of course, you might have to have a long shutter speed. That's the disadvantage. So I tend to always use a tripod when I'm shooting buildings. I don't use tripods all the time. It's not one of my favorite things. But when I'm doing buildings, I certainly, like to have that. You need a firm base for your camera because the building's not going to move and you don't want the camera to move.
No.
And even the tiniest, like when you with your finger, if you touch the shutter, even that tiny little bit of movement can introduce a bit of shake into the image. And with these, you want it to be critically sharp. So stick it on a tripod is always my advice.
And if you are travelling, do you travel with like a compact tripod, as it were, or something that's light?
Yes, I've got a small carbon fibre travel tripod, which is quite good. If I know I'm going to photograph, just going to do some architectural photograph, and I know where I'm going, I'll pack a heavy duty tripod.
Oh yes, yes.
You know, because they are. Well, I'll take it with me because it's all pre-packed, and you really want that stability. The travel ones are quite. I mean, these new ones are actually this carbon fiber one I've got now. It's so much better. I had a hollow steel one before that was it was a bit wonky.
Yeah, which is defeats the object, I guess.
Well, it does a bit. I mean, it's better than hand-holding, but it's not as good as a solid bass. But you, with these new ones, they are pretty good, but not as good as your old-fashioned heavy. I mean, you have to be prepared to lug around a bit of weight, but it, you know, it's worth doing. And then in terms of kit, you need a fairly wide-angle lens, particularly if you're taking, you know, really tall buildings. The wider your lens, the more it's going to give you flexibility, because you need a bit of room around the building to give you space to edit it later. So I would say round about 24 millimeters is a good place to start, wider if you can afford it. Once you go beyond that, you tend to restrict your ability to get a good image.
Why is that? Because you're losing definition? Well, or?
No, because you have to. You either have to get further away.
Ah.
Because with a wide angle, obviously, by definition, you've got a bigger field of view. So if you've got a narrower lens, you end up having to get further and further away. And then you have all sorts of problems about, you know, is the focus right? Have you got the right depth of field? With a wide angle, it kind of takes a lot of away of those issues. Takes a lot of those issues away from you.
Right.
Which is, you know, it makes life a bit easier. So as I say, 24 millimeters good, perhaps an 18. I wouldn't go much further than that, because once you get down to like 11 or 12, you're beginning to get a kind of fisheye effect, and that will distort the building as well. So you have to be a little bit careful.
Unless you want that effect, I guess. Well, some people do, don't they?
The other thing, you can't over-exaggerate it and go the other way. But the use of a wide angle, it gives you more to play with, and it enables you to do that, you know, straightening up with the image later in post-processing. And even that, you know, you can have fun with that. I was looking at, it's quite an old video now on YouTube about a guy who photographed the Leaning Tower of Pisa.
Oh, did I?
And then just as an exercise in showing how the software worked, he straightened it up. I think it was Photoshop he used, but
wow,
it looked really bizarre. It didn't look right at all, because your mind was expecting, you know, what you normally see with the Leaning Tower, and it was bizarre. But anyway,
it just shows you what you can do though with the technology. You know, world's a different place.
The camera never lies. That's
that's
never been true, but these days it's even less so than ever, I think. So that's probably the main points of, external photography. It's really about finding interesting buildings, and that's, you know.
And what about, avoiding people? And sometimes you might want people in there or other things to give you context, but
if you're doing pure architectural, you probably want to avoid people.
Yeah, but that's not easy, is it, depending on what you're photographing?
One way to do it is, of course, to use a long exposure. Because as long as the people are moving, they will move through the image and not be captured.
Ah.
If it's long enough. Otherwise, you end up with ghostly images.
Yeah, drifting through.
Yeah. I mean, it is unfortunately true of architectural photography. Very early in the morning is usually the best time to do it.
Yeah.
For two reasons. One, the light is nice and low. So, you know, it lights the building well, but two, there's nobody around.
Yeah. unless you all want to photograph the same thing.
Yes. Well, you do sometimes get that when there's particular things going on. And, you take places like Whitby Abbey. I know there's a little patch on the other side. I don't know if you know Whitby Abbey at all.
Sort of, yes.
There's a famous photograph that's been around since Victorian times, and everyone goes to recreate it. And it's been done so many times now that if you stand, there's a little pond in front of the field that leads up to the abbey. And on the banks of the pond, there's three or four places where you can see the tripod holes where every photographer sticks their tripod to take exactly the same picture of Whitby Abbey. And it's amazing. You know, I've seen it so many times. But if the lighting's right and you're lucky, you know, you can get a really
You can get an absolute, yeah. The envy of your fellow members or the club or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. This year's, I think the other thing to say about external buildings is don't forget the detail. So, you know, you might want to take the building itself, but then get in and look at the fine architectural detail and things. And particularly if you look at some of our cathedrals, you know, there's some fantastic carvings and statues, and getting in telling stories of that is good. I'm hoping to get over to Barcelona in the summer, and certainly one of my things is to go photograph the Sagrada Familia, which is the big unfinished cathedral in the middle of Barcelona.
Is it? Oh.
But it's kind of, it's a designed by Gaudi, which is really fantastic. But the detail in it is what I'll be after, as well as trying to get some images of the overall thing. And in fact, in this year's exhibition at the cathedral, one of my pictures I took at St. Pancras Station.
Did you?
Lots of the detail. There's a statue in St. Pancras of, it's quite massive, of I think it's called the Lovers. You remember that?
Yes,
and
I do.
I've taken pictures of that a few times, but it's just a record shot. It's hard to get very artistic because the background's cluttered and what have you. But around the bottom, there's like a frieze of other carvings of stories of travel and transport through the years. And I took about 12 individual photographs of those, and I've put them together as a collage, as a sort of architectural collage, which I entered in the exhibition, and it got selected.
Yes. So
that'll be in the exhibition.
Oh, excellent. Because you had one from, was it Amsterdam last year?
Yes.
Where you got very straight buildings, I have to say. Similar thing.
Except for the two in the middle, which were wonky, but that's how they are.
But that's how they are, but it's interesting. Yeah. So you are putting into practice what you're talking about there.
Exactly, yeah. Do what you say. And very quickly, let me just talk about interior photography, and that's it's mainly the aspects I'm thinking about is like the estate agent's photographs and insides. There are some tricks to think about when you're photographing inside. One of the key points is, I mean, light and shape and positioning is the same. It's just the same whether you're inside or outside. But one of the key points is don't take the photograph from your normal standing pose. Because in most normal rooms, that will make the room look smaller than it actually is. So your best bet is to get in a corner and then get lower. Shoot from below the level of a light switch.
Which
sounds a bit odd. Or even shoot, sit down and shoot from, I guess, what would be belly button height, if you know what I mean.
Ooh.
But it makes the rooms look bigger and taller and more spacious. Still think about, I mean, it's interesting, get your vertical straight, because you still may end up, depending on the size of the room, having to tilt the camera a little bit. So again, when you process it, make sure you've got everything straight, horizontally and vertically if you can. You can't always do that, but that's the main thing about interior photography. Do a bit of staging, you know, tidy up, get rid of the empty beer can on the table.
And the pair of slippers or whatever.
Yeah, exactly, and the cat on the TV, you know, all that sort of stuff. But I guess that's the main points of architectural photography.
Brilliant. But you know, one of my pet hates, Gareth, people put pictures up of themselves in somewhere glamorous or, you know, in front of something, and there's a litter bin or something, you know, really rubbish. And you think, don't you just think about what else is around you when you take that photograph?
I mean, there's nothing wrong with doing a bit of tidying up before you take the picture. You're right, it annoys me. And not just, you know, nice places. Everywhere, it's amazing how many people will take a picture of someone with a, you know, damn crisp packet in the picture. Or it's like, just move.
But it ruins the whole, because sometimes people put a really, like, romantic picture up or some big serious picture of them somewhere absolutely amazing, and it's just the worst photograph, from their point of view or the architecture, it's just what else is around in that picture.
It's about thinking about your photographs. That's one of my pet hates. The other one is where people put up a really nice picture of, you know, they're on holiday and they take a picture of their partner or their family, and you've got some idiot stood behind them gurning away.
Yeah.
just wait a minute.
Yeah, just wait till they've gone.
Wait till they've gone.
Brilliant.
Or ask them to move, or move your family. But don't take the picture and then sort of
and keep it.
You've got a minute. What's the problem?
I know. Marvellous, Gareth. I'm afraid we'll have to let you go. We'll speak to you next month.
Okay.
I'll be well. Excellent. And thank you very much. Fascinating, as always. Okay, cheers. Gareth. Bye-bye. Bye.
Bye for now. Bye.
The Ramdome is going to join in and sing along with his called Arch Empire.